So this morning we're going to be learning, we want to thank the Tigers for sponsoring. We're going to be learning Le'il Nishmas Avram Aviezer Ben Yosef. That's Mr. Abram Klempner. That's Judy's father, whose yahrzeit will be this evening. Our limud should be Le'il Nishmas. I thank you for contributing towards this learning. Our limud should be a true source for. So, today's topic is a practical guide for risk-taking. And it happens to be that this topic is quite a vast topic. And therefore, we're going to, maybe it's best to actually divide into two sections. One section is going to be the theory, and one section is going to be the practice. If we start just with the practice, it's sometimes a little hard to get a sense of what the tools were getting there. But if we only do the theory, it remains somewhat out there. Also wanted to add that Shalom suggested that the show is also sponsored by New York Life and Western Mutual. All policies available after this year. We'll see how much we need. We need to get into those questions, and maybe those are some of the shadows we'll deal with. Perhaps in segment two is life insurance and all the questions which revolve around practical questions today, like smoking and trips and all kinds of very exciting questions which we should address. When we think about this, we need to think about every time we think about risks. We can also, like, you know, just throw out a few very practical questions to sort of get the mind working. You know, can we drive in a car? You know, if we were to think about the statistics of driving, right? In Israel, there are more fatalities a year, unfortunately, on the roads than in terrorism. Okay? What about flying in an airplane? Today, 50 years ago, taking the train, skydiving. Don't want to mention this one, but skiing. Taking vaccines. Right, crossing the green line in Israel. So there's the question is when there's a risk involved in anything, you know, and there's also one has to think about, first of all, the level of risk, the probability of risk, and at the same time also what one's achieving via the risk. So that's what we're gonna have to consider, Be'ezras Hashem. But to start off, we need to start with the practical. So the perhaps the best way to start is to just in fact with two stories. Which highlight the complexity of these questions. You can't just ask any regular question where people take risks, because lots of people take risks today, but they aren't consulting Torah authority. So in order to start off, we need to find people who are taking risks, who are either Torah authorities or who have asked Torah authorities, and there's in fact a few very interesting questions that arise. So one of our questions takes us back to the year 1920. 1920 was a year. Remember, this is just after what has happened is that the British have taken over certain segments of the Middle East as the following World War I. So they've now divided up in the Middle East into various protectorates, and the area of Palestine is given under a British protectorate. And it was in the year 1920 that the tensions rose, because there were the Arabs living at the time, we're not going to call them Palestinians because that's not an authentic definition of a people, but the Ottoman Arabs who'd been living in that area, who are now under British protectorate rule, they were concerned because there was a lot of Zionist movement. There was a lot of movement in terms of the Zionist, we'll call it Aliyah from Europe, and also in terms of internal power base, and there was a. It was during a parade during the beginning of April. This is a regular parade, which is called Nebi Musa, which was supposed to be the time where a number of Arabs in Jerusalem would get together. And the British underprotected or only sent 188 policemen, and it turned into an incitement, which ended up in riots and looting and even killing of some Jews, and there were a number of Arabs killed as well during these riots. These were the predecessors to the 1929 riots. And this became the sort of first time where, you know, even under British rule, where this reached this this level. It was clear, it was known about, the British ignored it. The Christians would put painted crosses on their stores because they knew that in the Mea Shearim area, they knew it was coming. And nonetheless, this was incited by the mayor of Jerusalem, Husseini, whose nephew was Al-Amin Husseini, who later became the chief mufti of Jerusalem, the later incite of many, many deaths. And it was in this climate that we find ourselves thinking about Rav Yosef Chaim Sonnenfeld, who was one of the great Rabbanim luminaries of Yerushalayim. So what happens is that he happened to also be a Mohel. So here's the story that we have about Rav Yosef Chaim Sonnenfeld. You turn to the first page. We have this description. This is from a book called Ha'ish al HaChoma, The Man on the Wall, referring to Rav Sonnenfeld. And it says the following. Chibasoya azal eretz HaKodesh Motzo'o lifamim bituyim muchashim Shidimu games eile shiyadu v'ikiru es lahat nafshoy lechibas aretz. He had such a love and desire for the land of Israel that it went above and beyond anybody, any description that he, of the people who even knew him well. So Rav Moshe Bloy describes one of these incidents, which articulated his dear love for Israel. Before Pro'os Yisrael b'shnat taf resh pei. So when there were terrible things going on in the year 1920, so we know that this is the Nebi Musa riots, you go historically. There were real dangers just leaving one's house. He lived in the old city of Jerusalem at the time. There were real dangers involved. He accepted the invitation of being a Mohel. For a bris milah, that was one of the things that he did. Loiha ila kol tachanune b'nei bayis v'hu halach artuf b'talis v'tfilin lebris milah levado. He went by himself with his talis and tfilin to go and perform the bris milah. Where did he go? Mi bayis lo derech shar shchem. Now the bris milah was out in the Meir Sha'arim area. Okay, there was the little settlement. There was no Jerusalem as we know it today. There was just a little settlement outside, which is the Meir Sha'arim area. He walked out through the Shar Shechem, HaMakom HaMasukan B'Yoter, which was the most dangerous because it went straight to the Muslim quarter, of course still is, Ad the Makom HaBris, to the place of the Bris. V'samachti v'simchasoy acharei kein ha'isatzuma ma'od kishnizbarer loy she'im loy ha'yaba loy ha'yu malim esatinoik mivnei sheshum moya loy ratza levoy bizman ha'sakana kaze. He was so happy he did it because he realized there's no other moya to go. We know the Gemara we're going to see in a moment. Said that when you have a case, even though you're a shliach mitzvah, but the case over here you're talking about shliach hezeka, meaning you don't have to document it. You're seeing it, what's happening on the streets. How could you be walking there? Madua bachar derech shar shchem amusukan v'lo derech shar yofa amusukan pachus. You should have chosen Shar Yafo, which is an easier way. You go around the side of the wall, as we know. Hey Shiv, ma v'chi nafkir es roiva Shar Shechem. He says, should we abandon the quarter of the old city of Shar Shechem? Haloi im onu nefached aleches birchov ze yachshov hein shebeemes tzlichu legareisho sonu meharoiva. Loi ze loi. He said, I'm not going to tell Eligin and the success of showing we abandoned the Muslim quarter. Wow. God, asur lanu levater mipnei apachad al shum roiv of shum pinam Yerushalayim. You can't leave any corner of Jerusalem abandoned. This sounds like language you hear from different camps today, and it's an amazing insight. But what do you see over here? He put himself into not just theoretical danger, imminent danger, to be able to go and perform his bris milah. And in fact, the book continues not in the quoted part. Then in 1929, the same thing happens. In 1929, he was invited to a bris, and he was the Mohel, and at the time he was 80 years old. And the same thing happened. Remember, 1929, the massacres were on a much higher level. There were about, I think, 50 or plus people killed in Hebron, in the massacres, and there were people killed in Jerusalem. This was incited by the Mufti of Jerusalem himself, in all his magnificence. And what happened was, is he actually walked, and the people in his house were too terrified to even escort him beyond the street. And he carried on walking, he went through Shar Shechem, he performed the bris, and he walked back Shar Yafo. Same story and the same reasons he said later on, 9 years later. And so you have to ask yourselves, you know, obviously he was quite aware of the danger, but he nonetheless, of being aware of the danger, he still took the risks. So, you know, how do we view that in a halachic sense? If you reverse a few hundred years, the early 1800s, another example is the Talmidei HaGra. Today, if you go to Jerusalem, you walk through the old cities of Yerushalayim, There are still the Atikim, the old people of Yerushalayim, is a cluster of people called the Talmidei HaGra, the Vilna Gaon, living at the end of the 1700s. Tried to make Aliyah himself, wasn't able to, and instead sent his students as his messengers to the land of Israel to settle it. And we have their legacy there afterwards. Today, if you watch, if you look carefully, the Talmidei HaGra still wear their tefillin during the day. If you are able to usually pick them out in Yerushalayim, there are a lot of the Zilberstein schools system is a function of the Talmidei HaGra. Very, very ancient hold in the city. They also live in the Muslim quarter, many of them. What the leader of the group was a person by the name of Yisrael Mishklov. Great, great person. He wrote many sorim. Most famous one is called the Pas HaShulchan. And in his introduction, he describes what it meant to go to the old Yishuv in those days. I mean, it's tragic. When you read the words, you just cry. I didn't actually include the wrong paragraph in the notes over here, and I just reread it this morning. It's so tragic. He arrives in the Galil HaKodesh, he calls it. Now is where he started off in Sfat, and he moved to Jerusalem. And he literally describes member after member after member of his family dying. On his way from Tzfat to Yerushalayim, his wife dies, his wife from many years. And then his youngest dies, and his son-in-law dies, and the daughter dies, and his daughter dies, and he gets sick. Meaning, we're talking about a time where, you know, when you read the history of the time, there was no money, there was no, you know, this was an arid desert. There was nothing to support people. There was a disease of sorts which was spreading. And he describes the end of this terrible paragraph. He feels there's a chiyuv to describe why he's writing this book. And he said he brought up his grandson whose parents had died, and he brought him up to the age of 20, and then he too died. It's the tzaras that they underwent when they went to Israel is unimaginable. And he's lying on the roof of his place in Yerushalayim. And he's got a burning fever, he's sick, and he cries out to Hashem, and he makes a neder, like Yaakov Avinu says, if you let me live through this, I'll complete what the teachings of the Vilna Gaon, that I was his student, to write down his works on Seder Zeraim. And that was his neder. And he came through his sickness, and he became the head of the Kollel, he became a Shadran, which is one of the people who represented the Yishuv in Israel, and he went back to Europe to collect money. It's unbelievable. And you say to yourself, you know, risks, take it. That's a very heavy risk. I mean, that's a big price to pay for what he did. And you have to ask yourself, you know, to what end goal, and to what degree of probability of risk, and to what level of knowledge. Again, the question rises, and we're talking about the greats of our history. So let's start at the very beginning. So once again, today we're focusing a little on the theory, the building blocks. Next week we'll do some more casework itself, just to see the practical applications. Basics. Okay, so what does the Torah say about taking risks in general? Are we allowed to take risks? Are we not allowed to take risks? What are the concerns about taking risks? We're going to see an interesting notion that the concerns of the risk taking in the times of the Torah and the Gemara may be a little different than the times that we deal with today. So let's start off. Okay, so there's a famous number of psukim in Parshas Devarim which say the following. Now, if we read them in their context, we'll come out with a very different conclusion than if we were to read them with a halachic eye. So let's read them in context first. The Pesukim tell us in Perek Dalet, Pasuk Tes and Yud, Rak Yishom Elokal Shmona Shukha Ma'od, guard yourself very carefully. What is the concern? The Pasuk says, Pen Tishkach Es HaDvorim Asher Ra'u Enecho, O Pen Yosru Mil Vavucho, Kol Yimei Chayecho, V'adatam Levonecho, Livnei Vonecho. What is at stake over here? Why should we be so careful? We should be so careful too? To keep the mitzvah, meaning, and what's the concern? What's the threat? What's the risk?
Pass it on to your children.
Right, the risk is you may not continue to give it to your children. So the pasuk seems to be describing a physical or spiritual concern. This is a spiritual concern, right? Education, right? So that's what it seems to be. And a few pesukim later in Parak Pasuk Tezvav, v'nishmarta moed al nafshoseichem, be very careful about your souls. Ki loy reisem kol tmuna b'yom diber Hashem aleichem b'chorev mitoicha esh. Because you did not see any pictures when you looked at Hashem's glory in the Sinai experience. Lest you make yourself a image. By the way, it's interesting to note, if you go through the whole description of Har Sinai over here, the sensory description is, of course, with the way we interact with God is through hearing and not sight. Because if you're worried about sight, then if you're concerned about your interaction with God through sight, that's when you create pestle, images. It's interesting. Sight apparently is deviant. Nonetheless, it seems over here the Torah is telling us what you need to be careful about is making sure you have transmission, number one. And number two is making sure that you're not going to create Avodah Zarah from what you saw. That's what it sounds like. However, interestingly enough, the Rambam codifies this quite differently. The Rambam says that this has actually got very practical applications. We need to read this, we need to pass the pasuk into its individual parts, and we can take each part in, as a specific injunction. So Rambam says in Hilchos Rotzeach, v'shmiras nefesh, Rambam is talking about the halachas of being careful about murder. He says in Perek Yudal of pasuk, halacha dalet, echad hagag ve'echad kol davar sheyesh bo sakana roi sheyikoshel boi adam v'yamus k'goin sheyosah boi be'er o bor b'chatzeroi. So any time you have a dangerous place in your house, whether it be a high roof, whether it be a pit, whether it be something that there's a worry, a concern that people could hurt themselves in, ben sheyesh bo hen mayim, ben sheyein bo mayim, whether the pit has water or not, okay, so, swimming pool or just a recreational pit, chayev la'asos lohem chulya gavoya asor tvachim la'asos la'kisu kedesh lo'ipol by adam v'yamus. You need to make a wall around it at least 10 tvachim high, or you need to make a cover on it so that a person should not fall into it, rachmana litzlan. The Rambam says you need to be careful when it comes to any item which could be creates danger, and notice the word, you know, the word he says yafeh twice, right? So you've got to be extra super careful, right? I always wonder about this. You know, when you're walking in the street and you find a broken glass bottle, you know, if you're walking past that, you know, it's incumbent upon a person to, you know, you might not be able to have the broom and dustpan, but to at least move it to the side. They're dangerous things. As it says, Shneimani quotes up also in Dvarim Dalad, Hishamelucha v'shamar nafshucha. You should guard yourself very carefully. So what's the Rambam doing? He takes it out of its context and he says, Halachit is telling you not just about transmission, not just about your spiritual concerns, but the way you live your physical life. Be very careful. If a person did not, a person overlooked and was negligent in this case, you are as if you placed blood in your house, Rachman and Yitzhak, should something happen to that, says the Rambam. You say, you know what, it's fine, you know, it's my life after all, right? I can do what I want, I can jump off this building, I can do this, I'll be fine. So in the end of the day, Rambam says, Makinos and Makos Maridos, a person invokes at least a rabbinic injunction of getting Makos Maridos to put him back in place. And he gives a few examples. In the next one, you shouldn't drink loyanech piv al silon hamakaleach mayim v'yishte. You shouldn't just put your mouth onto a pipe of water. V'loyishte belayla mina naros mina agamim. You shouldn't drink just from the rivers and swamps at night. Why shema yivla aluka? You might swallow a leech. U'enaroy. Right. So these are the real dangers that existed in those times. So these are cases the Gemara quotes in the Rambam Paskins of La Halachas. The Rambam seems to take this notion that a person needs to be very, very careful about what they do. The first thing off the bat is the Torah seems to be concerned not just about our spiritual health, but the Torah seems to be concerned about our physical health. I remember that I had a Rebbe in Yeshiva used to say that even when it comes to jaywalking, you know, it's different in New York and outside of New York, perhaps. But when it comes to jaywalking, he used to say, be very careful when you're crossing the street, even if it's a red light. You don't want to put yourself into a place where the Torah told you, be very, very careful about your life. I actually remember I had a friend who got a ticket in the Tachana Merkazit for jaywalking. Can you believe that? That's the most rotten luck in the world. Anyway, so who doesn't jaywalk by the Tachan America Zid? Anyway, so Lamaisa, so the psukim themselves say that there is injunction of being very careful about one's life, not just spiritually but physically. How does this express itself in the Gemara? So the Gemara seems to have another concern altogether. The Gemara talks about another set of parameters which apply themselves to this rule. And that is the following. So the example is the Mishnah, there's many examples, but here's a few of them. So the Mishnah in Yuma talks about a following injunction, which the Kohen Gadol, had a specific one of his biggest day of the year. Everybody's biggest day of the year was, of course, Yom Kippur, right? So he's preparing for Yom Kippur, and one of the things that he can't do in preparation of Yom Kippur is that the night before he is, before he gets to his avodah, he can't eat certain foods. Why? So Gemara says because maybe he'll have a seminal admission which will invalidate him from being serving lifnai v'lifnim. So the Gemara has a long list of all foods that a person should not eat lest they come to a seminal admission. So here's the Gemara then questions the following, and the Gemara in the Yerushalmi says, and this is in the first source over here, which says, entitled "Not Relying on Miracles," the Gemara says, four lines from the bottle. V'loy min anisim shoyu nasim v'beis hamikdash hein. Was it not true that we list that one of the 10 miracles that were done in the beis hamikdash was that the Kohen Gadol was never invalidated from his service? So why are we so concerned about his menu in the days preceding his entering the Kodesh Kodashim? Am Rabbi Avin al shem lo sanason, because says Rabbi Avin, you don't test God. Meaning, ultimately speaking, in the end of the day, this problem never occurred. But the problem never occurred not because God just made sure that the Kohen Gadol was always secure. What that meant to say is that we need to do the necessary parameters, we need to take the necessary steps in order to make sure that it doesn't happen. Another example of this, the Gemara Shkan, this happens, this appears in Talmud as well, talks about the following. It says that in the Beis HaMikdash there were 13 tables. Okay, so we're talking about the second Beis HaMikdash. They arranged 13 tables for different uses. Some of them were made out of gold, some out of silver, and some out of marble. And then the Gemara starts dividing up which tables were used for what. So it describes that right next to the Mizbech, there was one of marble and one of metal. This is a shout out to all the people we did Talmud with on Shavuos night. And which were used for what? So the Gemara describes that the marble one was used for the kelim, and the metal one was used for the innards. Okay, the marble one was used for the innards, because what they do is they would wash out the innards, because obviously an animal that they had just shechted had been eating. So they wash out the innards on the marble table. So the Gemara says, why do you need to have marble and metal? Meaning, surely isn't the most beautiful material, of course, if you have gold or silver. I mean, like, imagine you go to IKEA and you ask for gold or silver, you know, countertops. You know, marble, okay, they've got. But like gold or silver, they don't have that in stock or you know, on demand. So why don't we just make all 13 of them in silver and gold? So Gemara says that the reason is because that we don't want to go. Of course, metal is a conductor, and therefore a metal is going to absorb and maintain heat. And you're going to now put the animal innards on those tables, and it's going to cause them to lahasriach. It's going to actually catalyze the rotting process of the biological material on them. That's why you can put the kalim on the metal, but you put the animal parts on the shayish, on the marble. So the Gemara says, but why do we need that? We know, and it's the same thing with the Lechem Aponim. The Gemara then asks in Yerushalmi the same thing. But in the day, we know there's a miracle that the Lechem Aponim was always fresh. So why do you need to start finding and now ordering marble tables? Get the metal, and that's fine. Miracles happen. The Gemara ends in the same conclusion. Again, Lo'et Nasun, Ein Soimchem Alanes. We don't rely on miracles. So the Gemara is now taking this beyond what the Torah says. The Torah says, be very careful with your soul, Ram Paskin Zalai Locha. The Gemara is now telling us another rule, and that is that you don't put yourself in a situation where you need to warrant Hashem's extra affordance of His help in order to get to the goal. That's what the Gemara is saying. Don't put yourself in a situation where you need... Now, by the way, let's just consider the risks here for a moment. The two cases we just described, what the risks are, let's sort of describe what would happen if you didn't do this. What would happen if you didn't do this? So let's say they only used... metal tables. They fed the Kohen Gadol whatever he wanted the week before. What is at stake? Let's think about this for a second. So I want to explore this for a moment. Is what is at stake is that a nace will happen, or is it at stake that in fact Hashem will leave us to our own thoughts? And ultimately the meat will either rot or rot faster, or the Kohen Gadol may in fact be invalidated from the service. First of all, the risks are the avoider inside, potentially, but I'm also suggesting that maybe the risks are the nace itself, meaning maybe invoking a nace is a problem. Right? That might be part of the risks over here. So as of now, this isn't immediately practical to the cases we're discussing, right? Because we're talking about relying on a nace, And the potentials over here are not life-threatening, they're avoidance-threatening, which could be very serious. But it's not the same as potentially the life that we're talking about before. And so, just like this. Yes, Steve.
Well, maybe we can't comprehend what the results
the repercussions. Good. Yes, yeah, so Steve, I thought about this. You're right. I mean, the repercussions of the Kohen Gadol's in being invalidated from service. Now, by the way, they did have a Kohen. They did have another Kohen who was in his place. You're right? So, but nonetheless, you're right. The repercussions over here could be national. Right? So therefore, we need to take this very seriously. Another example, Ramban says, asks the following question, beginning of Sefer Bamidbar, why are you counting the Jews so many times? Why are you counting all these Israelites? So the Ramban says, I have no idea why it is that we have so many counts. And he makes three suggestions actually. But take a look in the next source. In the second paragraph, he starts off by saying, V'yitachein sh'ne'mar oid. Maybe we could also say, maybe the reason why Hashem told us to count all those Israelites, you can imagine what a census must have looked like with Jews, right? It's complicated, right? So why do they do it? Because they wanted to prepare them like a king does, before they go to war. At the beginning of Parshas Bamidbar, before the chait of the Meraglim, they were destined to enter the land almost immediately, to fight the Amorite kings, the rest of the nations. As the pasuk describes, just before in Balayisrael, they needed to know the number of the people that could go out to war. V'chein mispar kol shevet v'shevet. Yifkod alav ba'arvos mav v'marchos milchama. That's why, by the way, the Ramban says, that's why the count is for males in warring age, right? Why isn't it everybody? This is because it is a military count. Even though the Torah blesses us that in the end we'll have one chasing thousands, but the Torah doesn't rely on that as its modus operandi. The way it tells us to operate is prepare for war. So the Ramban says is that the counting itself was once again another function of that same. Of that same notion, which is we're not going to put ourselves in a situation which demands that extra slack from Hashem's help. In that we rely on Hashem, we have to be tough on Hashem, but we don't go into war just sort of, you know, as a ragtag bunch of people who just fell off the boat into the war. We actually prepare for it, right? So this is the Ramban says as another expression of this. So this is our second notion. Notion number one is the Torah seems to say be very careful about the way you threaten your own life or others. Number two, the Gemara seems to be pointing to the idea that we don't rely on miracles. And number three, and this is actually a very interesting one, this one is perhaps not considered by most people, is the following, is that's using up merits. So he has a few cases where the Gemara describes it. Very fascinating cases. So here we are. In the next source, the Gemara in Shabbos, Daf Lamed Beis Amud Aleph, it says the following. End of the first line, it says, V'gavri heicha mibdiki. How are people checked for their merits? Okay? How are people checked for their merits? Okay, so how are people, Rashi says, what actions does a person do that opens up their we'll call it, give them a special audit, okay, in Shemaim? What kind of actions does one do, this or one should avoid, essentially, to avoid spiritual audits? Right, that's what the Gemara is asking. So the Gemara says the following, Amar Esh Lakish, B'shah She'ovrim Al HaGesher, when you walk over bridges. Now, if you want to get a sense of what this means, okay, we're not thinking about this, you know, the Verrazano. Okay, like think about those pictures of the bridges in the Amazon over the rivers, you know, with every third slat missing. Okay, now, you know, the type that if you sneeze, the whole thing turns over. So that's what we're talking about over here, the good old bridges. So it says, don't walk on bridges because that's when they do a spiritual audit. Why are they doing a spiritual audit? Why is it opening over there? Because you're putting yourself in a vulnerable situation, which puts yourself in a vulnerable situation. They say, really, you know, so you really think that you are a likely candidate to reach the other side? Well, let's just make sure that you are, right? So that's what the Gemara says. Now the Gemara says, Gesher v'tula. Is there no other examples? So is that the only example? Says Emor ke'ein Gesher. No, anything like that bridge in the Amazon. Ravloy avar b'mavro de Yosef be'akum. Omar dilma mifkid le dina ale umet v'sina b'hade. He says, Rav would say that he wouldn't go in a a ferry across the river where there were non-Jews there, because he felt maybe if their time has come, maybe he's going to be the unfortunate bystander of their judgment as well. I remember there was a story, I think it was Rav Zev Lev who was talking about, he was on a plane, and he was and the plane was delayed because they had engine trouble, and I think they had engine trouble, and so they were in the sky, in fact, and it was being there was a long delay, and they offered extra drinks so that everybody could feel, the passengers could be a little more relaxed. And there was one guy behind him who was really going at it, and the guy got completely drunk and was telling the whole world about everything, and he just had a fantastic meal, and he just said, you know, I feel like my whole purpose in life has been reached at this point, you know, like in his drunkenness. And he got really worried. He said, if he's done, that means we're all done. So, you know, you don't want to be on the same boat as people like that. So so the Gemara says that's why a Rav would not go on such ferries. Shmuel had the opposite reason. Shmuel lo'avar ela b'mavro de'isbei akum. Amas sitna b'tray umeloi shalit. He said, it can't be that I'll go definitely with non-Jews because I want to make sure that the Satan won't be makatrek different nationalities all at once. He felt that it was protected in, we will call it diversification of risk. Okay? So this is what Shmuel felt. And Rav Yanai bodik v'avar. Rav Yanai, he would look, before he went on, he did a quick inspection. In those days, they didn't have to inspect their ferries every year and get a special stamp and emissions test. He checked to see if there were any holes, and then he went on the ferry. Rav Yanai l'tami d'omar l'oilam al yamad adam b'mokom sakona loy marsh oisim loy neis shemo ein oisim loy neis v'im oisim neis menakin loy mischuyosav. So Rabbi Yana says that the reason why you don't rely on a miracle, why not? Why don't you put yourself in a vulnerable situation? Because you might have to afford yourself a miracle, and the miracle might not happen. But what's the other side? If the miracle does happen, what's the problem? Yes, that's a lot of spiritual credits, right? That's a lot of spiritual credit that's being taken up over there. So one of the other threats about putting oneself in a vulnerable situation is you don't want to be drawing on that balance. Okay, and we see that from Yaakov Avinu as he quotes, Yaakov Avinu says that he doesn't want, he's too small from all the chesed and the emes. Yaakov Avinu had a very good spiritual portfolio. But nonetheless, he felt that he didn't want to access, he didn't want to take the credit on that, against that. They say about the Chavetz Chaim, that the Chavetz Chaim, when you used to go to visit his house, it was a very, very simple house. In fact, the chairs in the Chavetz Chaim's house didn't even have backs. And somebody asked, oh, I once asked the Chavetz Chaim, you know, you're one of the leaders of this generation. You're the luminaries of society. Surely we can just buy you chairs. And he said in a terrifying way, you know, if the wherewithal that I have in this world is my expense account for the job I'm doing. So if I start upping my expense account, they're going to say, well, is he validating that expense account? Meaning, is this agent, is he bringing back everything he needs to? And the Chavetz Chaim was concerned about taking, going that far. That's ad kedei kach, or in terms of drawing into spiritual credits. We don't think about it in the same terms. You know, they say about, you know, people, when people are very concerned about financial planning, and they should be. We have all sorts of consultants and advisors and plans and budget plans, and it's very important. And then when it comes to spiritual things, people say, I'm sure it'll work out in the end. You know, I'm sure by the end of the day it'll all work out. It's the Gemara saying that it's really the other way around. You don't want to say, you know, sometimes we need to also say in the financial sector, okay, it'll work out, we're not going to cross every T. But when it comes to spiritual realm, we've got to be very careful about what we draw off our credits. Now, it's another example of this. The next case over here. The Gemara says, this is a Gemara in, Gemara in Tainist, Mechofim Abayis. So it says that, so let's start on the third line. It says, "Ki ahi ashisa reua tahava b'Narda." There was this wavering, this shaking wall in the city of Narda. Narda was one of the great Jewish communities in Babylon. "Deloy hava cholif Rav Ushmuel tute." So Rav and Shmuel would never walk along that street. They felt that this was a condemned building, and they felt that they couldn't walk under that building. "Avogav dekaima ba'astra tleisar shnin," even though it had been standing for a while, but they just felt that it wasn't a wise thing to walk underneath it. Yomachad ikla Rav Ada bar Ava lahasam omale Shmuel leRav Nesi mar Nakif. So Rav Ada bar Ava arrives in Narda, and they're walking down the street. They need to get to the destination. This street is on their path, and Shmuel says, "Well, let's take the roundabout route to avoid this building." Omale loit sarichna ha'idna de'ikor Rav Ada bar Ava b'hadai nafish tzchusa v'loi mistafina. He says, "With Rav Ada bar Ava, we can walk along," meaning he bears a lot. So, you know, he's got a lot of spiritual credit. We can walk through this way. And in a similar vein, Rav Huna then tells a story about how he had a lot of wine, he had a lot of his merchandise in a particular building. The building was a very, very weak building. So what did he do? He invited Rav Ada Bar Ava to the building and had a conversation in Halacha with him. In the meantime, he asked his followers to remove the merchandise. And when he finished, when the merchandise had been finished being removed, he and Rav Ada stepped out of the building collapsed. Right? So then Rav Ada Bar Ava was upset with Rav Huna, because Rav Huna was essentially using his spiritual credit as an umbrella for his removal of the merchandise, and he felt that there was too much of a withdrawal on his side over here. Again, the notion that we don't put ourselves in situations which demand too much of a spiritual withdrawal. And by the way, the Rambam actually paskins this. The Rambam actually paskins the next source. We're not going to read inside, but the Rambam paskins when a person should not walk under a kir notoi, what's it called? A leaning wall. Okay, so a person should avoid such things. The Rambam describes it in terms of danger, but in the Gemara's terms, it was because not just the danger, but also there's the danger on the one side and the withdrawal on the other side. Those are sort of the two sides of this coin. Another example, famous example, is that Rav Yaakov, Rabbi Yaakov, had a famous comment that the two mitzvahs where the Torah describes that there is going to be long life, longevity, explicitly are Kibbutz Av Ha'Em and Shiloh HaKein. Right. So those are the two cases that are described. And he said he witnessed a case where Rachmana Litzlan, a parent, tells a child, "Go get the mother bird, chases away the mother bird, comes down, dies." And he said it's clear that the schar can't be this worldly alone, and must be l'yom shekulo aruch. The Gemara then just says, well, maybe. The Gemara starts asking questions on that story, many, many questions. We dealt with this a little bit a year ago, unfortunately, about Shluchei Mitzvah. And let's look at the this is the Gemara in Kedushin, Lamed Tes Mem Beis, appears in Kuf Mem Beis in Sanhedrin as well. The Gemara says at the end of the first wide line, V'har Rabbi Lazar Shluchei Mitzvah, V'har Rabbi Lazar Shluchei Mitzvah Eno Nizakim. How could it be? He was sent by a mitzvah. Forget the aspect that this is a mitzvah that's got longevity attached to it. He is a shliach mitzvah. How can a shliach mitzvah be harmed? So the says a shani and nizakim hasam alichasam shani. So he says maybe that it's different because he was on his way back. He'd finished the mitzvah again. He says no. V'homer Rabbi Elazar shluchim mitzvah and nizakim leva alichasam v'lebe chazarasam. So he says no. They got immunity on the way there and back. So the Gemara says, well, maybe Sulam Re'ua Havo, maybe it was a shaky ladder to Kaviyah Hezeka. V'kohecha to Kaviyah Hezeka lo yasamchina nanisa t'yachseva yom Shmuel eich eilech v'shoma sha'u v'hargeni. So the Gemara now says, you know what? Maybe the case is we're talking about a shaky ladder, and the shaky ladder means to say you're putting yourself in imminent danger. Imminent danger is not going to preserve a person's life in this case. It's not going to be sufficient grounds for protection. So the Gemara says that similarly therefore the rule of Shluchei Mitzvah and Nizakim falls by the wayside. Similarly by Shmuel says, you know, I'm not going to go and anoint David publicly because Shaul's going to kill me, but surely God just told you to do something. The answer is, well, Shkei Chezeka, Shaul is dangerous right now. I'm not going to put myself in that situation. That's what he suggests. So, you know, sort of putting all this into the, you know, into the combine harvester, what do we come out with? You know, like if we you know, what do we draw from all of this is that the Torah does seem to be very concerned about taking unnecessary risk. And Shnatan and Nashua Seichem, the Gemara and the Ramban even reads that into the Torah itself. The Gemara seems to be concerned about doing the necessary prerequisite preparation in order not to rely on an ace. And the flip side of relying on an ace, of course, is that either the ace won't happen for you and you're going to be in deep water, or that you won't be in deep water and you will have now made a very big withdrawal in your spiritual bank account. So with all these cases in mind, the question is how do we ever do anything? Right? Meaning, how do we take any risks? What are the mitigating factors? So here we go. So this is the jumping off point. Oi. So this is why we can't do all the practical cases in one day. So let's concentrate on a few cases over here. We see actually the Gemara is that describe people who did take actually very dangerous risks. Notice, here's a few examples. They talk about Nachum Ish Gamzon. This is a Gemara in, I think this is Tainus, Chavad of Amud Aleph. The Gemara says, Nachum Ish Gamzon, he was, at the end of his days, he became very, very sick. He lost his eyesight, he lost his hands and his arms, and he had leprosy. A terrible, terrible description. And the reason why he ascribed to that at the end of the Gemara is because he was once He had three donkeys worth of stores and food and drink, and a poor man accosted him and said, "Please, can you help give me something to eat?" He said, "Let me unload first." He unloaded, the man died. And he felt a debt for that person's death, and he felt that he had a debt for the hands and legs and sight that he didn't use for helping that person in time. And he took that on his own as retribution. He actually called it upon himself. At the end of his day, he was living in this most terrible, decrepit state. He was living in a house. The house was actually, they found out was not a safe house. And his students said, "Let's remove you." And they said, no, it says, he says, "Remove everything and everybody else first from the house, and then you remove me." And as I removed him, the house collapsed, similar to the Rabbi Adda story. And the question is, it sounds like he is taking a risk, meaning he is using himself as a shield, actively, for the other people. So he's putting himself in a situation of risk on behalf of everybody else. How could he do that? Similarly, there's another story about later on by Nachdimon ben Gurion. This is in Yud Tesamah Beis. The Gemara describes where Nachdimon ben Gurion took a very, very heavy loan. He took a loan of 12 wells that he could use to help sustain the people who are going to do Aliyah LeRegel. And he promised to pay them back by a certain date. And if not, he'd pay a immeasurable amount of silver to pay for those wells. And there was no rain. It was no rainy season. He couldn't pay back. There was no water. And he relied on a miracle that the wells were filled up. And they did fill up in the last few fractions of the moment of the day. And again, like he puts himself in a state, you know, in those days when you didn't pay debts, there was no declaring bankruptcy, if you know what I'm saying. In those days, you usually meant you're hung, drawn, and quartered kind of thing. How could he do that? There's many, many, many cases that describe this. Nachum, Rabbi Chanina ben Dosa talks about a case where there was a pit where there was a serpent in it, and so what he did was he put his foot over the pit, stopped the serpent coming out, and the serpent bit him, and the serpent died. And he said, "You see, the chait kills, not the snake." And like, you know, so how could people put themselves into these situations actively and confidently in a situation of risk? How does this all work? So one approach which is offered is based on the Gemara in Bava Basra. Gemara in Bava Basra actually talks about the Benos Tzlafkan, and it says that they all got married pretty late on in life. They got married after the age of 40. And the Gemara says, but you know, biologically speaking, that's a bit of a risk that they're taking. Because in the end of the day, there's a chance that they potentially may have trouble having children at that point in time. How could they do that? So the Gemara says, the Gemara's answer is, "Mitoich shetzidkonios hay nas elohem neis kiyocheved." They were tzidkonios, they were very, very righteous ladies, and therefore they put themselves in a situation because they knew that a nes would happen for them like kiyocheved. So again, they're putting themselves in a situation. So the Rashbam suggests, and many point out, based on this Gemara, that one of the mitigating factors for a person to take a risk is if you really are a tzaddik and you know full well and sure that you have the credit, you can take the risk if there's a need, a communal need. So for instance, in this case, there's a communal, in the cases of all the cases we saw beforehand, Chanina ben Dosa, he was performing something which would be a national news. People would realize that to put his foot over the snake's cave, where it talks about Nachdimon ben Gurion, who is now providing water for all of Israel, or the case of Nachum Ish Gamzu, where he is protecting the students who are in the building. In all those cases, there's a greater need, and for a greater need, when the person is confident of their spiritual merit, that person can do this. Now, this has very little application to today, because today we don't, if you meet somebody who says they've got sufficient spiritual credit, that's probably a good indication that you should not be in the same building as them when the building's falling down. So this is one of the tirutzim which is offered, and it does explain certain cases, but it's very sort of ethereal and disconnected to the nuts and bolts that we deal with on a daily basis. So, which also, by the way, just as a horror on this case, is Yaakov Avinu seemed like he didn't want to take that route. When Yaakov Avinu said, "Katati v'kol achasad," and Yaakov Avinu did have spiritual credit. So that's just a little bit of a footnote on this. That's approach number one, which is suggested, which is not as nogea to us today. Second approach, which is fascinating, I'm going to go just a few minutes later, I apologize, just to get a little bit of a heckef on this particular side, but then we'll continue next week, God willing. Similarly, by the way, that's why Avraham Avinu says this is where we actually started this was supposed to be the Shira on Parshas Lech Lecha 2 weeks ago. 3 weeks ago, and this is how the Chavetz Chaim says in his footnotes to Avas Chesed. He says this is how Avram Avinu actually went into war with the four and the five kings. Meaning, you know, like, you know, you don't have to be a statistician to realize that Avram Avinu's odds were pretty low. You know, he was going to war with putting himself into a war where, just to appreciate this, you know, Kedar LaOmer, is attributed by the scholars to be Hammurabi. Okay, you know, you got to read Hammurabi's steles and read how powerful the man was, and he thought he was a demigod. You know, I mean, like we're talking about a very, very powerful person. And Avraham Avinu, and you know, whether you say it was 318 men he had with him, or Eliezer, whichever way you cut it, statistics are not working in your favor. So how did Avraham Avinu put himself into that risk? It's a similar notion of the fact that he felt confident, and there was a need which he felt mitigated the situation. There's another approach which is also helpful, and that is the notion of Kiddush Hashem. Or we'll call it Hatzolas Rabim. What happens if what's at stake isn't just a public announcement, but what happens if many people's lives are at stake as well? What do you do then? So some of the poskim suggest, the Stei Chemed, in fact, makes a suggestion. Take a look at the top. Oh, this is our, what number is the source? I don't have the numbers in front of me here. The For Saving Others, under the title called For Saving Others. In the Sefer Av Chochma, does it read 15. So the Stei Chemed is quoted as following, saying the following: A Stei Chemed Mavir, he kinire loy lichare shemutel adar nistaken kedei lahatzil rabim shlo yinazku. When can a person put themselves in danger? Is in order to prevent damage to many people. Okay, so on a 1-to-1 basis, you can't do that because you don't have the right to make the decision of one person over another. But what happens if there's many people at stake? Another potential option. So he feels that the reason why Rabbi Chananya ben Dosa put himself in danger to stop the snake or this reptile coming out of its cave was because he felt that it was a public hazard. So he himself took the risk on behalf of the community. That's why Nachum Ish Gamzu stayed in his building till the end, because he felt that the lives of his students were at risk, many other people. He felt that the water was a life-sustaining force for the people who are going to be walking from very far. When you deal with a communal need, an all-encompassing communal need, he says, when you talk about the communal needs, then you give it a whole different perspective on the needs of the individual. We'll call it greater good, which of course is a dangerous concept in general, but over here is being used as a place where a person may be allowed to put themselves at risk. This does have some practical applications. He goes on to quote in the Sefer Av Chochma, a case where a soldier was asked Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach about, he was in the intelligence corps, and he was his job was deciphering messages from another country, and the problem was that they needed to decipher thousands of messages, but some of them were very helpful for national security, some of them were not as helpful. Could he break Shabbos for this? Right? So, meaning, to what degree is that pikuach nefesh? And he said that Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach paskened he could decipher all the messages, like his mefaktim commanded him. Why? Because even though maybe pikuach nefesh of an individual, maybe you might say the parameters are somewhat limited, when you come to pikuach nefesh of a greater community, and this could be national security, that's got a much greater level and significance as an application of this particular rule. Now, interestingly enough, what was at stake over there was Shabbos, not risk. But nonetheless, the same application he's using in this case. And finally, one last thought in this particular area, and then we'll close for today because of time concerns. And that is the following. And we'll perhaps develop this a little more next week. That the Gemara has, in a number of cases, a notion which evokes a particular pasuk called Shomer Pesayim Hashem. Hashem looks after foolish people. Okay? God looks after foolish people. And the Gemara applies this in a case came into Doshul Bei Rabim, when many people go along a particular path, a path which is well beaten. Then in that case, a person is able to evoke this notion of what's called Shomer Pesayim Hashem. The Gemara talks about it, where let's say there's, the Gemara talks in a more controversial sugya about contraception for people who, for ladies who it is dangerous to get pregnant, and the question is when one can evoke the notion of Shema Psoim Hashem, in particular instances. Other cases are where a person eats certain fruit at night, and there could be dangers involved. The Gemara says, don't worry, Shema Psoim Hashem. There's many cases the Gemara evokes this. How does this play itself out, lahalacha? So, interestingly enough, there is a beautiful tshuva by the Shem Aryeh, who says, and this will perhaps we'll end with this paragraph, and then continue with the practical coursework next week as the more practical cases. So he says a very fascinating rule. V'da, he says, you should know. Da'afu devarim sheyesh bohem sakana. This is towards the end, the very very last page. V'da bedvarim sheyesh bohem sakana mikol makom b'davar shul min haga shul olam v'derech hechrech en nachosh. If you have something which is natural and necessary, okay, those are his two conditions. You have something which is natural and necessary, there's no concern of the risks involved. So, dahare, arba'ot tzrichim lehoidos, ubeiz mehem holchim idboros v'holche yamim. We know that there's a birkas ha-goymel on four situations in life, and two of them are situations which are situations where a person puts themselves there voluntarily. So when it comes to being sick, Rachman Litzon, or being put in prison, those are generally not voluntary electives. But when it comes to going to sea and going to the Midbar, it is. Harei, de'ikah bohem sakana, there's danger. U'mikol makom mutar lifrosh lifros b'sina ve'leilech b'midbar. You still can go and make these trips, whether it be for business, whether it be for visiting people. V'ayim ba'orachayim, resh v'mches, l'inyan im mafligim samuch l'shabbos, if you can go to Shabbos, that's a separate conversation. Al b'chol shari, you can definitely go on a boat during the weekday. V'lama lo yer, sor mishum sakana. Why aren't you concerned about the sakana? And he quotes Yerushalmi, which says that going to the Yamagodol, going to the Mediterranean, is a terrible danger. He quotes in the end of the line, El Avada, that's the abbreviation, debidvorim ka'elu asherhem letzorecha olam, and Yisr Klal. These are natural, necessary steps for trade, for human communication. You need to do it, so there's no concern. V'chein ein Yisr l'isher l'hizdakek l'baylo afal gadaleh l'havisakana. He says, what about pregnancy? Pregnancy carries with it risks. Right, so how is it that we are able to be blessed with children? He says, because despite that, that's the way of the world. The necessary risks, we're talking about in a normal case. Even though the woman herself is not a mitzvah in peri of yerivya, skipping down about eight lines.
We know that most roads are considered becheskas sakana in a we assume that they are dangerous. Im kolze mutalotzeis ladera lechay benichnas the krach the tzorich lispal muktam. We know that a person should say that to the Sederach, which indicates that it's dangerous, unless a person should go, is allowed to go on the Derech. He concludes, interestingly enough, he says that if you're going just on a trip in a boat, just to see things and not for need, this is one should avoid this. Now, remember, the Shem Aryeh is talking about, of course, at a time where boat travel itself was even more dangerous than it is certainly today. But his two parameters of applying this klal of the Gemara of Shomer Psoim Hashem is number one, where there's a need, and number two, where there is where is minag shel olam, where the people take those risks regularly. What we're going to have to do next week is apply this. So what about specific cases? What about particular cases? We're going to go through some of the response literature on very particular cases to deal with. Just as a recap for the theory that we worked through today, the concerns were Nishmartan wanted a national safety, evoking nace, and evoking spiritual withdrawals in the bank accounts. Some of the mitigating factors were the notion of perhaps great people who can do it, the tzorech rabim, or the pikuach nefesh of rabim, and finally the notion that we have a special rule, shoyim psayim Hashem, which can be evoked in particular cases. Now the question is application. So, with that, we will start next week.